Thomas Jefferson survives, but so do the ideas and the America of John Adams. And I, for one, thank God for that.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, now having studied in depth some of the great statesmanship of President Washington, in this next lecture we're going to get to see two of the real mental, conceptual ideas architects of the American Republic, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Why are we going to spend some time with them?
We're focusing on them for two reasons, one for an American historical reason and one for a Jewish historical reason. The American historical reason is that even as Washington is the hero of the Revolution, really the two minds that gave us the Revolution were Adams and Jefferson, because they were intellectual compatriots and the best of friends before they became political enemies. And then, of course, they became good friends again at the end of their lives. Benjamin Rush himself says somewhere to Adams that you and Jefferson thought for the all. Others fought for us, in other words, he's saying, but the two of you thought for us. Jefferson is the one who actually put the American idea into writing in the Declaration. But it was Adams, really, who made the case for the Revolution on the floor of the Congress, day after day after day after day. So it behooves us to ask, if these are the intellectual architects of the American idea, what did they think about religion in general? What did they think about its place in society? And what did they think about Jews and the Hebraic tradition? If you've ever traveled to Washington, D.C., you'll see that the train station or airport souvenir shops are replete with items that have words emblazoned all over them. So there'll be ties that have the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights on it, t-shirts with the Constitution, things like that. Because it is words, not images, that embody America. Similarly, if you visit any of the memorials in Washington, D.C., Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, there's certainly images there, but the stone is emblazoned with their most famous and influential words. Now, London has nothing like this. As Rabbi Sacks noted, what's incredible is if you visit the Churchill Memorial. Churchill is, as JFK put it, the man who mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. So if anybody should have words, it's Churchill. There's nothing. I've been there, it's just a statue. No speeches, no quotations. Similarly, if you fly out of Heathrow, no one's selling the Magna Carta on a tie. All right. What's for sale is not words, but images. You could buy souvenirs of Buckingham Palace, or Windsor, or Big Ben. You have pictures of British royalty. Now, the reason for this difference between American culture, I think this is not insignificant. It's important. And it lies in the fact that America is the first country in millennia that is founded around an idea or a group of ideas, ideas that we have been discussing, equality, liberty, inalienable rights. And though it was Washington's leadership on the field that allowed the American idea to triumph and endure, there were really two others that were its intellectual architects, and that is Jefferson and Adams. They were, in Joseph Ellis's words, the odd couple of the Revolution. Adams, the highly combustible, ever-combative, mile-a-minute talker. Jefferson, the always cool and self-contained enigma. It was Jefferson who composed the words of the Declaration that changed the world. But it was Adams who had time and time again made the case on the floor of the Congress for independence and for breaking with Britain, a according to one of the delegates, Adams was the man who sustained the debate and by the force of his reasoning demonstrated not only the justice, but the expediency of the measure. And despite original opposition to Adams's views, when the fateful vote took place, the vote came out to 12-0, with New York abstaining, to its eternal shame. And it was, of course, Adams who actually convinced Jefferson to write the Declaration in the first place, and it was his idea to make George Washington the general of the American army. Adams and Jefferson were the best of friends until the end of the 18th century, when they turned into rivals and then ultimately enemies, only to be reconciled at the end of their lives by a mutual friend and the true hero of this entire lecture series, which is, of course, Benjamin Rush. And then Adams and Jefferson engaged, one in Quincy, one in Monticello, in one of the most fascinating correspondences and intellectual exchanges in history. Adams and Jefferson differed about a great deal, but one issue that came up in their letters in their old age was religion and Judaism in particular. Jefferson was long a hero to Jews for reasons that we will discuss. And yet his own views of historical Judaism and of the contributions and temperament of the Jewish people remain negative, indeed at times virulently so. Adams, on the other hand, as we shall see, had great admiration for the Israel of the Bible and for the rabbinic tradition. And this is interesting in its own right, but what I want to suggest in my talk today is that this allows us to get at the root of their more general disagreement and to better understand how they each in their own way impacted America, for Jews, but also for the entire nation. Well, let's begin with a brief analysis of Adams and Jefferson's interests and beliefs. First, they were both brilliant men of ideas. They were first and foremost intellectuals. That is the root of their bond. Today, it's often a political liability for a politician to be an intellectual. That's a sign that you're not a man of the people. Adams and Jefferson were intellectuals par excellence. In Jefferson's library, after the British torched Washington, Jefferson's library was so massive that he gave it to Washington and it formed, or sold it rather, and it formed the Library of Congress. Adams spent the last decade of his life reading every book he could get his hands on and carrying on imaginary dialogues with them by writing copious comments on the margin. And though much of their respective lives were devoted to politics, throughout their lives they maintained also an active interest in philosophy and theology. And that's why their correspondence following 1808 is devoted in great detail to religion. In their dogmas and doctrines that they each held, they may have seemed similar, as they would have both called themselves Unitarians, and that they were believers in God who denied traditional Christianity's notion of the Trinity. But they were actually quite different. Jefferson was essentially a deist. In the words of the historian Richard Samuelson, to whom this lecture and my thinking about Adams is greatly indebted, in Jefferson's scheme, God was the creator of the universe, but the idea that God was an active presence in the world he dismissed as mere superstition. Indeed, it's worth mentioning that though Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration, if you want to see something very interesting, you should Google Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration. And though it does have some of the most famous phrases, the phrase at the end of the Declaration, what I've called before the covenantal aspect of it, invoking a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, that was added. That was not by Jefferson. That was not in the original. Jefferson, as an adult, really never prayed. For Jefferson, it was reason and only reason that was to serve as man's guide. And the notion of faith and of believing in something because of tradition or revelation would be to him just silly, and not only silly, but a betrayal of our truest human nature. Adams, while also a very great believer in human reason, held strongly to the importance of religion in forming a moral life for individuals and for a society, and especially in a democracy. Because if the power of the state was to be vested in the will of the people, then nothing prevented the populace from running morally amok except their own self-restraint. Recall the biblical verse that we cited in the seeming contradictions about the Bible's approach to monarchy. Samuel is insulted when they ask for a king, and yet the Bible adds, as was mentioned, in those days, says the book of Judges, Ein melech b'Yisrael, there was no king, ish kol hayashar b'einav yaseh, all would do what was right in his own eyes. So if you don't have a king, if you don't have a centralized, absolute monarchy, how do you prevent the people from running morally amok? In a letter as president, Adams wrote, that we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Jefferson, in contrast, once wrote that he believed the American experiment to be, quote, to show by example the sufficiency of human reason for the care of human affairs. In order to show the contrast, let's compare two letters of advice, both written to young men setting out on lives of intellectual exploration. One was written by Jefferson, and one was written by, not John Adams, but his partner in every aspect of his life, and that was Abigail Adams, one of my favorite people in American history. So here's the first letter. This is written by Jefferson to his young nephew, Peter Carr. He writes, he's going through different subjects. So he writes, religion. Your reason is now mature enough to examine this subject. Fix reason firmly in her seat and call to her tribunal every fact, every opinion. Question with boldness even the existence of a God. If it ends in a belief that there is no God, you will find the incitements to virtue and the comfort and pleasantness you feel in its exercise and the love of others which it will procure you. If you find reason to believe there is a God, a consciousness that you are acting under his eye and that he approves you, that will be a vast additional incitement. That's Jefferson. Our second letter is written by Abigail Adams to her son John Quincy Adams in 1778. John Quincy Adams had the most incredible resume of any American. He sails to Paris when he's 10 years old, 1778. When he's a teenager, you're talking about a 13, 14-year-old, he's asked to serve as the secretary to, I think, the ambassador to Russia or something. And his father says, sure, and just ships him off, you know. So then he came back, was senator, the greatest secretary of state we've ever had, and then he became president. He was the one who came up with the Monroe Doctrine. So she's writing to her son, who she knows is brilliant. He's 10 years old. He's going to France with his father, to the center of intellectual ferment. So you'd think that she would see this as just nothing but a boon. He's going, this is going to be amazing. He's leaving provincial America and going to a place where his mind can really roam. But she's worried. She's worried about what will happen to him morally and religiously in France. And so she writes to her brilliant boy to say that for all the opportunity he was about to encounter, it was faith and morality that remained vital, and that without that, all other achievements are worthless. She writes the following, and the entire letter is worth looking up because it really is one of the great letters written by a parent. She writes, great learning and superior abilities, should you ever possess them, will be of little value unless virtue, honor, truth, and integrity are added to them. Adhere to those religious sentiments and principles which were early instilled into your mind, and remember that you are accountable to your Maker for all your words and actions. The point then is that comfort and pleasantness, to use Jefferson's words, in doing virtue, was not always a sufficient incentive, and reason must be combined with belief in a providential God. Now, with that in mind, we can turn to Judaism. For Jefferson, who considers reason the foundation of all progress, the very notion of faith or divine inspiration and of having a doctrine that insists that there are hundreds of divinely inspired commandments and rituals that must be obeyed because of the revelatory word of God, this to Jefferson seemed preposterous. And so Jefferson wrote in one of his letters in 1820, the whole religion of the Jew was founded in the belief of divine inspiration. The fumes of the most disordered imagination were recorded in their religious ode as a special communication of the deity. Jesus' object was the reformation of some articles of the religion of the Jews as taught by Moses, wrote Jefferson. And Moses, Jefferson added, had presented for the object of their worship a being of terrific character, cruel, vindictive, and unjust. Moses, Jefferson wrote, had bound the Jews to many idol ceremonies, mummeries, and observances of no effect toward producing the social utilities which constitute the essence of virtue. The Jews, Jefferson further added, were a bloodthirsty race. I think he's talking about biblical Jews, but he spoke about contemporary Jews as well, as we'll see. The Jews were a bloodthirsty race as cruel and remorseless as the being whom they represented as the family God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the local God of Israel. One correspondence between Adams and Jefferson concerns the rabbinic tradition. J- Jefferson had read an author just that describes in a very biased and bigoted way the rabbinic tradition. And Jefferson buys it entirely. And so he's reporting to Adams what he had read in this book about Judaism. And he says that ethics were so little studied among the Jews that in their whole compilation called the Talmud, there was only one treatise on moral subjects. This is, of course, Pirkei Avot, right? Which is actually not about ethics. So that's, I hate the title Ethics of the Fathers, but leave that aside, of course. There are ethics throughout the Talmud, but he's just buying this. And then he goes on to say to Adams, he's writing this to John Adams, this is after they've been reconciled, end of their lives. He writes, "It may serve to give the reader some idea of the low state of moral philosophy among the Jews, to add that it was judged sufficient to fulfill any one single law in the hour of death." This is a takeoff of the rabbinic teaching, Yesh kona olamo b'shah achat, one can acquire his portion of the world to come in one moment. Writes Jefferson, "What a wretched depravity of sentiment and manners must have prevailed before such corrupt maxims could have obtained credit." That's Jefferson's letter. So we could put Jefferson down as undecided about Judaism. Okay? But one striking side note should be made here, because this is really fascinating. Around 20, 25 years ago, there was an article in the New York Times that reported that biologists had begun investigating the genes of the Jefferson family, because they were interested in figuring out whether the Hemings family were actually descendants of Jefferson. But this research led to another discovery, and that is that Jefferson's Y chromosome is of a genetic branch that is quite rare, known as K2, and it originates in the Middle East. Jefferson's ancestors, on the other hand, came from Europe. Leading scientists to posit that there was one main source of Caucasians with Middle Eastern genes that were living in Europe, Jews. And so the Times interviewed Michael Hammer, that's the scientist in Arizona who discovered the Cohen gene, also a Y chromosome gene. And he said that he had compared the Jefferson Y chromosome with those in his database of Y chromosomes and found a perfect match to the Y chromosome of a Moroccan Jew. Dr. Hammer said he would tentatively hazard a guess at Sephardic Jewish ancestry for Jefferson. But it is striking, because Jefferson may very well himself have been, not halakhically Jewish, but the descendant of the very race of people that he is describing in such unfair and often cruel terms. For the Adams family, not that one, the other one, on the other hand, it was an undeniable fact that there were many nations of great intellectual achievement who made discoveries in art, astronomy, science, philosophy, and mathematics. And yet, what struck them, both father and son actually, is that the notion of an omnipotent, just, and moral God did not occur to any of them. John Quincy Adams himself has a whole series on religion, essays that he wrote to his son. And he wrote that, quote, "It is the God of the Hebrews alone who is announced as the creator of the world. The ideas of God entertained by all the most illustrious and most ingenious nations of antiquity were weak and absurd. Thus far and no farther could human reason extend. But the first words of the Bible are, 'In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth.' This blessed and sublime idea of God," wrote Quincy Adams, "of God, the creator of the universe, is revealed in the first verse of the book of Genesis." And so if Jews hit on this idea, first, that means that they are extraordinary. And second, it must mean that, perhaps even, that more than just reason was at work. Perhaps they were, at least at one point in history, actually chosen. And so John Adams Sr. has several famous statements about the Jews, often written to a correspondent of his by the name of James Van der Kamp. And he writes the following. Here is one of them. He says, "England and France are the two nations to whom mankind are under more obligation than any other except the Hebrews. I accept that the Hebrews, for I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of morality and of all civilization. That's one letter from John Adams, John Adams Sr. Here is another to James Vanderkamp. He writes the following. What a wonderful genius was Machiavelli, you exclaim. Wonderful indeed. What a wonderful genius was Hobbes, Priestley, Bonaparte, Voltaire. All very strange geniuses, however. I have read this last fall half a dozen volumes of this last wonderful geniuses. That's Voltaire. He's writing sarcastically about Voltaire, whereas Jefferson loved Voltaire. Of this last wonderful genius's ribaldry against the Bible. How is it possible that this old fellow, meaning Voltaire, should represent the Hebrews in such a contemptible light? They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth. The Romans and their empire were but a bauble in comparison of the Jews. They have given religion to three quarters of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any nation, ancient or modern. That's John Adams. So, the achievement of the Jews, then, is unique for him. And perhaps they might even say, in his family, that reason alone could not have achieved it. That something else seems to be at work, providence, or maybe even chosenness. Similarly and remarkably, in their correspondence between Monticello and Quincy, after he receives this letter that I quoted before, where Jefferson speaks negatively of the rabbinic tradition and says, oh, it only has one tractate on ethics, and it has all these crazy moral teachings, Adams writes back to say, basically, well, have you gone through Shas? Right? He basically says, I wish I had the time to go through Shas. He doesn't call it Shas. He writes the following. He says, to examine the Mishnah, Gemara, that's his words, to examine the Mishnah, Gemara, Kabbalah, Yetzirah, Zohar, Kosri, and Talmud of the Hebrews would require the life of Methuselah. And then he refers to the burning of the Talmud in Europe. If you've ever been to the Hotel de Ville in Paris, you are standing where the Talmud was burnt, and where Maram of Rotenburg wrote the famous elegy that you Ashkenazim will read this Tisha B'Av. So Adams refers back to it, Shali Srufa Ba'esh. So he refers to this event, Adams, and he writes, 20 cartloads of Hebrew books were burnt in France. And how many times 20 cartloads were destroyed in the other kingdoms? The Talmud of Babylon, this is Adams to Jefferson, the Talmud of Babylon and that of Jerusalem were composed from 120 to 500 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. How many proofs, he writes, how many proofs of the corruptions of Christianity might we find in the passages burnt? So for Adams, rabbinic tradition, not only did he feel that Jefferson was giving it short shrift, but he thought the tradition, he's a Unitarian, he thinks that rabbinic tradition might teach us some of the errors that he believed Christianity had believed. Now, he doesn't believe that, he's not converting to Judaism. Okay? He still wants Jews to, as we'll see, to become Unitarians and become like just like him. But this is what he's writing. In another noteworthy letter to Jefferson discussing their mutual denial of the doctrine of the Trinity, Adams writes, and these are the actual words, had you and I been 40 days with Moses on Mount Sinai and admitted to behold the divine Shekhinah, that's his words, and they're told that one was three and three was one, we might not have had the courage to deny it, but we could not have believed it. And so, Adams was not an Orthodox Christian, though he certainly called himself a Christian, and Unitarians was a Christian denomination in those days, at least, and he was certainly not an adherent of Judaism. But he did not despise the traditionalists of various faiths. Because he valued faith's role in society, he recognized that faith could be positive even if people believed in doctrines that were, at least in part, in error. And it was important that people had faith, even a variety of faiths, because he understood as well that not everyone would have the same religious beliefs as himself. So it's with their differences over social religion in general and Judaism in particular that we can now understand with greater depth how this difference over the achievement of the Jews is actually so inextricably linked with their original political falling out. This truly began with Adams as vice president, a position that he called the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. His main job was to break ties in the Senate. When he began involving himself in debates, the Senate made a rule that he wasn't allowed to talk. That was a rule they passed. So Adams would just sit and write essays while he was sitting in the chair. What was going on at the time was the French Revolution. And he published a book of reflections on the French Revolution, which has extraordinary parallels to Burke's Reflections on the Revolution of France. This is called Discourse on Davila. It's much less famous than Burke's work, and he was not as felicitous a writer as Burke. But one of the points he made was that given that France had not only overthrown their king, but their entire religious value system, and installed the strict secularism, lacking the notion of human beings created in the image of God, he predicted that tyranny and mass murder would result. And he writes the following: "Is there a possibility that the government of nations may fall into the hands of men who teach the most disconsolate of all creeds, that men are but fireflies, and that this all is without a father? Is this the way to make man as man an object of respect? Or is it to make murder itself as indifferent as the swallowing of mites on a morsel of cheese?" It's an extraordinary prediction of what would occur in France, and also gives you an insight of what cheese was like in those days. "If such a case should happen," says Adams, "give us again the gods of the Greeks, give us again our popes and hierarchies, with all their superstition and fanaticism, impostures and tyranny." Meaning, he's saying, because he doesn't think highly of Catholics, but he's saying, better the Catholicism of the French monarchy than what is happening now. Meanwhile, Jefferson praised the Revolution as the natural successor to the American one. And he said that, quote, "rather than it should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated." And also said, "all the old spirit of 1776 is rekindling," meaning in France. When our old friend, who we've discussed before, Thomas Paine, wrote a pamphlet attacking Adams, responding to Discourse on Davila, Jefferson wrote a haskama. He wrote words of recommendation for us, a blurb of sorts, which Adams took very personally, as well he should. It was in this environment that two parties began to emerge, known as the Federalists, who were certainly opposed to what was happening in France. And this is a simplification. There's many, many divisions. And the Republicans, or the Democratic Republicans, who celebrated it. In 1796, Adams and the Federalists defeated Jefferson and the Republicans. 4 years later, another election was held. And if you think that political language is uncivil now, you should study American history. One of my pet peeves is when people make comments that show that they know nothing about American history. So people say, this is the most negative time that we've ever lived in. People are saying negative things on the internet, and people are only reading media and watching media that agrees with them. Read about the election of 1800. Jefferson describes that people would not talk to each other. If a Democratic Republican saw a Federalist coming down the block, they'd cross the street. And they would attack each other in print. There was no mainstream media that put on a veneer of objectivity. There were Federalist papers and there were Democratic Republican papers. So, and Jefferson himself was the first person to run a negative campaign in American political history. Because, unlike Adams, we'll come back to this, he was a skilled politician. And Jefferson hired a man named James Callender to publish attacks on Adams. James Callender called Adams, quote, "a hideous hermaphroditical character, which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman." Meanwhile, one Federalist newspaper wrote that should Jefferson win, "murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of distress. The soil will be soaked with blood. The nation black with crimes." So this is what was going on in 1800. This is what was going on. And it's in this environment that Jefferson, in a letter, and this is just out of nowhere, he's writing a letter about the Federalists. And he writes the following. He describes the Federalists as political opponents, whose power base was New England. Jefferson's power base was the South. Adams's power and the Federalist power base was New England. And the swing states were the mid-Atlantic states, New York and Pennsylvania. And it's in this environment that Jefferson, in a letter, writes about the New England Federalists as follows. He writes, quote, "Seeing that we must have somebody to quarrel with, I had rather keep our New England associates for that purpose than to see our bickerings transferred to others. They," meaning the Federalists, "are circumscribed within such narrow limits and their population so full that their number will ever be the minority and are marked, like the Jews, with such a perversity of character as to constitute from that circumstance the natural division of our parties." So you read that and you think, where did that come from, right? Why did you bring that up? And he chooses, apropos of nothing, to compare the Federalists to Jews, which is odd, especially because most Jews were Jeffersonians and adore Jefferson. Indeed, I have a whole theory to show that if you study the election of 1800, you'll see that New York City swung the entire election. Because in those days, electoral votes were assigned by the legislature in New York, not by popular votes. So who would win the electoral votes depended on which party would win the legislature. And since New York City sent as a block, meaning all of New York City voted, sent as a block 11 representatives to the legislature, they determined the majority of the legislature. And the Jews were the swing vote in New York. And they almost all voted for Jefferson. So it was they who swung the Electoral College, which means, of course, that we get credit for the Louisiana Purchase as well, obviously. So it's very odd that he's referring to Jews in discussion of Federalists. It could be just a side gripe, or perhaps he saw a Jewish notion in the Federalist insistence on religion as essential to a moral political society. And it was in this election, with New England supporting Adams and the South Jefferson, that the scales were tipped by New York, who voted for the Jeffersonian ticket. Not only because the Jews were Jeffersonians, but also because New York Senator, a man by the name of Aaron Burr, was running for president on Jefferson's ticket. Burr, of course, ended up becoming the first vice president to shoot somebody, but not the last vice president to shoot somebody. Now, that begs, all this is fascinating, I think, but it begs the question, if this is how Jefferson felt about Jews, so why did Jews love Jefferson so much? And how did it result that there was one Jew, a grandson of Jonas Phillips, who adored Jefferson to the extent that he devoted himself to saving and preserving Jefferson's legacy? There are two answers here. One is more substantive, and the other more superficial but important. The substantive point is this, that Jefferson, whatever his feelings about a particular sect or faith, Jefferson was single-mindedly devoted to religious liberty for all and to ensuring the achievement of that at every level of society, and to enshrining that concept in the letter of the law. And so one of Jefferson's achievements of which he was most proud was that he was the author of the Virginia Declaration on Religious Liberty, which he wrote in the late 1770s, though it did not become law until 8 years later. This was a revolutionary document because it essentially disestablishes religion in Virginia, stops Virginia from having a national church, removes all religious tests for office. Adams, while he certainly felt much more positively about the Jews and may have even been in his own way philo-Semitic, writes a constitution for Massachusetts in 1780, has religious tests for various offices, some tests which Jews themselves would not pass. And so Jews saw this about Jefferson, and they knew that Jefferson would fight, if not to the death, then to a great extent, for the right of even a faith that he thought was ridiculous, to have the absolute freedom to be an equal in society. Jefferson meant it. Jefferson said a lot of things he didn't mean, but he meant it when he said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal vigilance against any tyranny over the mind of man. That was Jefferson. So there is that substantive point. Jews knew this about Jefferson, and they revered it about Jefferson. So in Jefferson, you have absolute dedication to achieving religious liberty in law. And that, of course, filters down to his great student, Madison, and in part thereby makes its way into the Constitution, as Jonas Phillips demanded. That's to the credit of Jefferson. Adams, on the other hand, might not have insisted on that being in the Constitution. But Adams exemplified, as a Puritan from New England, a different aspect of the American relationship with the Jews. Not necessarily, at least in the 1770s, a dedication to ensuring the religious liberty in all governmental aspects, but an admiration for the Jewish story and an identification of America with the Jewish story, which we've explored as well. That aspect of America can be seen in Adams's writings. That's the substantive difference between them, and one of the substantive reasons as to why Jefferson was so deeply admired by Jews. The less substantive, but still very important reason, is that Jews didn't really know what Jefferson thought about Judaism, because Jefferson was an incredibly skilled politician, and in contrast to Adams, was a smooth operator. Fact remains that in the great debate over France, it seems quite clear, at least to me, that Adams was correct in his prediction that this revolution was very different than the American one. It was Jefferson who was blind to what was occurring. Nevertheless, it is Jefferson who went on to become one of the most revered presidents in American history, because Adams, unlike Jefferson, did not know how to effectively lead as a politician. After Washington, America became profoundly political, and Adams could not be smooth. Adams could only be blunt. Adams could only be candid. He could not have a discussion with you without telling you exactly what he thought about you and about your faith and about what you believed. That was John Adams. Famously, Adams said to Jefferson that when he said to him, you should write the Declaration, and Jefferson said, well, why don't you write it? So he said, you have to write it for three reasons, he says to Jefferson. First, because you're a Virginian, and it's important for a Virginian to be at the head of this thing. Second, because I am obnoxious and disliked, and you are very much otherwise. And third, you can write 10 times better than I can. He understood this, I have to step back and have someone else do this. So that's the less substantive reason for the Jewish love for Jefferson. But it's an important one, because without that skill, you cannot effectively lead. That was inherited by his son, the greatest Secretary of State America has ever had, but one of the least effective presidents America has ever had. Because it is one thing to be a brilliant Secretary of State. It's another thing to wield power as a politician from the White House. It's an entirely different skill, and the two do not necessarily translate. So you have Jefferson, the smooth operator, but who is also ideologically wholeheartedly devoted to religious freedom for all, even those whose faith he thinks is ridiculous. And you have Adams, the curmudgeonly, stubborn ideologue who I love, but who's not smooth at all, but has a genuine love and reverence for the history of the Jewish people. To show this difference between them vis-a-vis the Jews, let us look at correspondence that each of them had with a Jew. In fact, this is a Jew who is not only the most prominent Jew in America in the 19th century, but who was also another grandson of Jonas Phillips. And the first moment in American history where the Phillips family and Jefferson actually genuinely intertwine before the family ends up buying his home after his death. And the man I'm speaking of is Mordecai Manuel Noah, whose picture today hangs at the entrance of my synagogue, Sheareth Israel, and was without question the most prominent American Jew of the first half of the 19th century. So let me briefly give you his life story and what brought about his correspondence with Adams and Jefferson, because this is a fascinating American story in its own right and tells us also a great deal about Judaism and America. So here's the background. Jonas and Rebecca Phillips, as I mentioned, had 21 children, most of them who survived to adulthood. One of them, not the one whose wedding was attended by Rush, which is Rachel, but another one of them, Tzipora, married a German Jew by the name of Manuel Noah, and their first child, Mordecai Manuel Noah, was born in 1785. Mordecai Noah's mother died when he was a child, and his father abandoned him. And Jonas Phillips raised him. He was raised by Jonas Phillips. So according to the historian Robert Gordas, it was his grandparents who imbued him with a deep-seated reverence for American liberty and with an equally staunch pride in his people and his religion. He goes south originally. He gets involved in journalism. And then at the age of 28, he is appointed in the Madison administration. He is appointed the American ambassador or consul to Tunis, becoming the first Jew in America to receive such a major political appointment. And he actually dealt with a hostage crisis between America and the Barbary pirates. He also became the first federally appointed Jew to get fired, and probably was fired for being a Jew as well, because he received a letter from Secretary of State Monroe during the Madison administration, which stated, "At the time of your appointment as consul at Tunis, it was not known that the religion which you profess would form any obstacle to the exercise of your consular function. Recent information, however, proves that it would produce a very unfavorable effect, in consequence of which the president has deemed it expedient to revoke your commission. Respectfully, James Monroe." Now, this ruined his political career, but not his faith in America. And upon his return, he became the editor of the National Advocate, which was the prominent Tammany Hall publication in New York. And he becomes very, very much a part of Tammany Hall politics. It is in this status as one of the most prominent Jews in America and in New York that in 1818, when the Jews of New York and Share with Israel dedicate a new building, they invite him to come give the dedication address. It's an extraordinary speech for two reasons. First, it is a patriotic Jewish reflection on America. And second, it probably qualifies as the first Zionist essay of the modern age, decades before Herzl. Because Mordecai Manuel Noah was a proto-Zionist. And he says as follows, "After recounting the sorry situation that Jews had faced in much of the world, Noah then reflected on the country in which he lived. And he says, 'Let us turn from Europe and her errors of opinion on points of faith to contemplate a more noble prospect. Our country, the bright example of universal tolerance, of liberality, true religion, and good faith.' Noah knew that even in the France of the Enlightenment, Jews were not accepted in society in the same way. He knew of Clermont-Tonnerre basically saying, we'll welcome you as Frenchmen, but not as Jews. But Noah said to his fellow Jews that this country was different. Until the Jews can recover their ancient rights and dominions and take their rank among the governments of the earth, this is their chosen country." This seems a natural thing to say, but remember at this point, the Jews in America were some thousands, while in the world they were very many millions. And as much as Noah loves America, he staunchly maintains that the Jews had to still dream of going to the land of Israel, something he believed might happen soon in the future if the Jews took upon themselves to do so. And he said, quote, this is 1818, "Never were the prospects for the restoration of the Jewish nation to their ancient rights and dominion more brilliant than they are at present." This is, I think, the first Zionist essay of the modern age. And it was said not in Europe, and not by Moses Hess, and not by Theodor Herzl, but by Jonas Phillips' grandson, Mordecai Manuel Noah, in 1818 in New York City. And by the way, he actually took action on this. And in 1825, acquired a parcel of land in upstate New York, across the river from Buffalo, which was to serve as a Jewish colony until the Jews, so to which Jews could come from all over the world and live in freedom, practice their faith, and then perhaps ultimately make their way to the Promised Land. And he called this island Ararat, because Ararat is where Noah found refuge after the flood, and his last name was Noah. And so that's what he did. And so that was his plan, and on the 3rd of Tishrei, September 1825, he held a grand ceremony. And you can go to this day and see a building there with a plaque that actually says on it, "Shema Yisrael, Adoshem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, a city of refuge for the Jews founded by Mordechai Emanuel Noah in the month Tishrei 5586, September 1825. And he said, unlike American Reform Judaism, in his address he says, it is proper for me to state that this asylum is temporary and provisionary. The Jews never should and never will relinquish the just hope of retaining possession of their ancient heritage. And then he publishes ads in all over Europe saying, Jews, come here. And all the Jews say to their rulers, this guy's a Meshuggah, we are not. We love Germany. We are not coming back. That's Mordechai Emanuel Noah. This is an unbelievable man, raised by Jonas Phillips. Now he takes this address, this where he talks both about how America alone of all the nations on earth had offered the Jews religious liberty, and this notion that one day the Jews might restore themselves to the Holy Land. He takes this address and he mails it to Jefferson, Adams, and Madison. And he gets letters back from them. Jefferson sends him a letter. Adams sends him two letters, one in 1818, and then in 1819, when he publishes another book, which he sends to Adams, Adams sends him another letter. Let me read you these letters, and you will see the differences between Adams and Jefferson, vis-a-vis the Jews and vis-a-vis their entire approach. Here is what Jefferson, this is Jefferson's letter. I thank you for the discourse on the consecration of the synagogue in your city, with which you have been pleased to favor me. I have read it with great pleasure, with pleasure and instruction, having learned from it some valuable facts in Jewish history, which I did not know before. Your sect, by its sufferings, has furnished a remarkable proof of the universal spirit of religious intolerance inherent in every sect, disclaimed by all while feeble and practiced by all when in power. Our laws have applied the only antidote to this vice, protecting our religious as they do our civil rights, by putting all on an equal footing. But more remains to be done. For, although we are free by the law, we are not so in practice. Public opinion erects itself into an inquisition and exercises its office with as much fanaticism as fans the flames of an auto da fe. The prejudice still scowling on your section of our religion, although the elder one, cannot be unfelt by ourselves. It is to be hoped that individual dispositions will at length mold themselves to the model of the law and consider the moral basis on which all religions rest as the rallying point which unites them in common interest, while the peculiar dogmas branching from it are the exclusive concern of the respective sects embracing them and no rightful subject of notice to any other. So you see how smooth Jefferson is. He says, I don't like when people look down on Judaism. You know, I don't like that. But he's also, and this part is sincere, his focus is on that getting to a point where there is absolute freedom for all. Because he sees America as moving away from the Catholic Church and its history of persecuting the Jews. And that, he says, is what I want America to be. That is Thomas Jefferson's letter to Mordechai Emanuel Noah. Now here is the two letters from Adams. The first is 1818. Sir, accept my best thanks for your polite and obliging favor, and especially for the discourse enclosed. I know not when I have read a more liberal or more elegant composition. You have not extended your ideas of the right of private judgment and the liberty of conscience, both in religion and philosophy, farther than I do. Mine are limited only by morals and propriety. I have had occasion to be acquainted with several gentlemen of your nation. Some of my best friends are Jews, and to transact business with some of them. That's Adams. Whom I found to be men of as liberal minds, as much honor, probity, generosity, and good breeding as any I have known in any sect of religion or philosophy. I wish your nation may be admitted to all the privileges of citizens in every country of the world. This country has done much. I wish it may do more. Let the wits joke, the philosophers sneer. What then? It has pleased the providence of the first cause, the universal cause, that Abraham should give religion, not only to the Hebrews, but to Christians and Mohammedans, the greatest part of the modern civilized world. So he begins in this sort of clumsy way, saying, yeah, some of my best friends are Jews, I've done some deals with them, right? But then he says, look, people may sneer at you, but God has chosen you to communicate monotheism to humanity. So his admiration for the Jewish people shines through. Now here comes the next letter, 1819, one of the most remarkable letters in American Jewish history. This is the words, John Adams to Mordechai Emanuel Noah, March 15th, 1819. Listen to this letter. He writes, Dear Sir, I have to thank you for another valuable publication, your travels in Europe and Africa, which though I cannot see well enough to read, it's 7 years before his death, I can hear as well as ever, and accordingly have heard read 2/3 of it, and shall in course hear all the rest. It is a magazine of ancient and modern learning, of judicious observations and ingenious reflections. I have been so pleased with it that I wish you had continued your travels into Syria, Judea, and Jerusalem. And then he continues, I should attend more to your remarks upon those interesting countries than to any of any traveler I have yet read. If I were to let my imagination loose, I should wish you had been a member of Napoleon's Institute at Cairo. Nay, farther, writes Adams, I could find it in my heart to wish that you had been at the head of 100,000 Israelites, indeed as well disciplined as a French army, and marching with them into Judea and making a conquest of that country and restoring your nation to the dominion of it. For I really wish the Jews again in Judea an independent nation. Okay? So far, so good. Okay? I love you guys. I want you guys to conquer the Holy Land and set up a new country. This is how he responds to the first proto-Zionist, Jonas Phillips' grandson. He's smooth sailing so far. Okay? Then he adds, and this is how he concludes. He writes, "For, as I believe the most enlightened men of it have participated, meaning of Jews, in the ameliorations of the philosophy of the age, and once restored to an independent government and no longer persecuted, they would soon wear away some of the asperities and peculiarities of their character, possibly in time become liberal Unitarian Christians. For your," and then he says, "God's name is our God's name, and your God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is our God. I am, sir, with respect and esteem, your obliged, humble servant, John Adams." End of the letter. So this is the letter, right? On the one end, you have him saying, you guys were chosen by God and providence. Your story is the greatest story on earth. And then he just can't help himself. And he says, you know, and once you're there, once we establish the Jewish state, you guys will all become Unitarians just like me. Jefferson would not have said, I wish you guys were at the head of an army marching into Judea and establishing an independent Jewish state. Can never even imagine in your wildest dreams Jefferson writing a letter than that. But he had the seichel. He had the political sense how to write a letter and how to respond to somebody who runs a newspaper when you're writing a letter. That's John Adams, one of the most remarkable letters, and to which I say again, say, as I said with Savannah and Newport, Washington's letters, we all treasure the Jefferson letter. Where's this Adams letter? Let's get a hold of that. Let's buy that and put that on display. I really do wish the Jews in Judea an independent nation. Second President of the United States, 1819. That's John Adams. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died on the same day, July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day of the Declaration of Independence. One of the greatest proofs I have ever seen of the providence in which Jefferson probably did not believe, and of the hand that that providence had in the making of America. John Adams on that day famously said words which we'll discuss in our lecture this afternoon, Thomas Jefferson survives. And the truth is, Thomas Jefferson does survive. His ideas survive, and his impact on America survives. But John Adams survives as well. Both have impacted America, and both of them and of their approach to religion can be seen in part in what made America a special place for Jews. It was Benjamin Rush who, after he reconciled Adams and Jefferson, who wrote to John Adams saying, I rejoice in the correspondence which has taken place between you and your old friend, Mr. Jefferson. I consider you and him as the North and South poles of the American Revolution. Some talked, some wrote, and some fought to promote and establish it. But you and Mr. Jefferson thought for us all. That is true. They were the intellectual godparents of the American idea. And for the Jewish experience in America, their experience here was in part because of the religious liberties that were enshrined in the Constitution, which then led it to becoming enshrined in laws throughout the United States. And much of the credit for that goes to Jefferson. But they also, as we have been discussing, found a home in America that was special because of the affection for Jews and for the biblical heritage of Israel that was made manifest in the lives of many New England Americans. And Adams is probably one of the greatest embodiments of that. And so we give glory to Jefferson while understanding with history what he thought about the Jews. To me, having seen the room where Jefferson died and stood in that room seeing the bust of John Adams that he had right near him when he passed away, and knowing that that bust, that original bust, is still there because it was a Jew and a Jewish family that saved Jefferson's home and preserved his legacy. When I stood there seeing John Adams' face, I could not help but think that somewhere John Adams is smiling at how this all turned out and thinking that you, Jefferson, did not give the Jews enough credit and did not realize what a remarkable people they really were. And so, indeed, Thomas Jefferson survives and John Adams survives. And their impact on America can be seen throughout. The religious liberties that we enjoy in law are a credit to Thomas Jefferson. But he would be surprised at the vibrant nature of many traditional religious faiths in America. Jefferson believed in the ultimate progressive triumph of reason and predicted that, he said, when I die, there will not be a single young man that is not a Unitarian. John Adams, while he probably wanted people to convert to Unitarians, valued faith and understood that not everyone believed what he did. And he would not be that surprised to see an America that also has groups of traditional religious faiths, Catholics and evangelicals, a vibrant Orthodox Judaism, homegrown religion called Mormonism. That aspect of America is Adams' America. So they are both the godparents of the American idea, and the Jewish experience in America is indebted to them both. Thomas Jefferson survives, but so do the ideas and the America of John Adams. And I, for one, thank God for that. Thank you very much.
In this lecture that we just saw, Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was so interesting how the French Revolution is a way to see, is a test that you can open up and look at how the two men reacted to religion in the public square.
Yes, here you have a whole other revolution taking place. And it's easy to see why an American would be excited about this revolution. The Americans had led their own revolution against monarchy and tyranny, and their allies had been the French. And now the French, perhaps inspired by the American Revolution, are now rising up against monarchy on their own. Adams and Jefferson had both spent time in France, and now they're both back in America. And so if one is excited about it and one isn't, they're both equally familiar with the country of France. That tells us something profound about their different approaches to not only the French Revolution, but to the American Revolution. And as well, it tells us how their different views about how important the role of faith in a revolution actually is.
What role do you think that time and thinking about the generations, something that's so important to the Jewish way of thinking about the human condition, what role do you think that played in each of the thought of Adams and Jefferson?
Yeah, there's clearly a debate going on here about, in the revolution, how much are they saying goodbye to the past? And how much of the wisdom of the past are they taking with them? And so, as others have noted long before me, the debate between Adams and Jefferson about the French Revolution is paralleled in the debate between Burke and Paine about the Revolution. On the one hand, Adams understands, as he himself says, we are in the midst of revolution, he says about the American Revolution, something like the greatest in the history of mankind. He knows that what they're doing is new and extraordinary. But how new and how extraordinary? And how much of the wisdom of the past is necessary to take with us. And that's exactly, in part, what Jefferson and Adams are debating. But they also have another debate going on. There's a wonderful scene. How historical this is, I'm not sure, but it is beautiful depiction of their disagreement in the HBO series John Adams, where they're both sitting with Franklin in Paris after the war has been won, the Treaty of Paris has been signed, and Adams is about to leave, saying goodbye to his best friend, whom he doesn't know is going to become his political enemy. And Adams has just been informed that now he's going to be the ambassador of the United States, the first ambassador to the court of St. James. And they're not talking about the French Revolution because that hasn't occurred yet. But they have Jefferson saying his famous line that he really believes that no generation has a right to bind another generation, that every generation should be able to make up its own laws. And then Adams reacts with horror. And Jefferson says to Adams, "You, Mr. Adams, have too little faith in your fellow man." And he responds, "And you, Mr. Jefferson, have too much faith in your fellow man." And so Jefferson is embracing the utopian spirit of the French Revolution. Adams, in his discourse on D'Avila, reacts with horror to the utopian nature of the French Revolution and understands that a revolution shorn of certain concepts that were essential to the American Revolution, that we are created in the image of God, and it is from that that our rights derive. There is a sanctity of human life that is linked to the divine, and that without that, all you will have is bloodshed and tyranny. Adams is horrified at the French Revolution. And so you have this true break. The irony, of course, is that in this falling out, Jefferson triumphs, even though I believe history shows that Adams was right in the debate that divided them. But that leads to an entirely different difference, which I also discussed in my lecture, which is that Adams was not a good politician. Jefferson was an extraordinary politician.
Next on Jewish Ideas and the American Founders, The Home We Build Together.